the first question for today, which will be question 15.
Okay, this is Tiana. Yesterday when you were talking about seafloors, you talked about the Canadian Arctic seafloor and the interior Arctic seafloor. Where is the interior Arctic?
Hi, Tiana. That's a good question. I got to look at my map here, too. But basically, maybe I didn't quite make that clear. The interior Arctic is really the deep Arctic Ocean, and the interior Arctic basically has several ocean basins and several ridges, but overall the water depths are deep. I mean, they're several thousand meters deep, and then there's the so-called shelf seas, and I think I was referring to the Canadian and the U.S. shelf seas, one of which, for instance, would be the Chukchi Sea. If you look at the Chukchi Sea or the Beaufort Sea, for that matter, most of the water there is only a couple of tens or maybe a few hundred meters deep, in contrast with the interior Arctic Ocean, which is much deeper.
Okay. Zalbanils, can you ask question number one?
Have animals or plants gone extinct because of climate change and no other reason?
Hey, now that is a very good question. Andy, the student who's working with me, whom you talked to last week, and I, we're sitting here and we're sort of scratching our heads. I mean, you got to remember, a lot of these questions about climate change are very complicated. That is a very good question, and you can already tell by the way I'm sort of wriggling in my seat here that there is no easy answer. But before I even try to come up with an answer, and Andy hopefully is going to be able to help me on that one, I just want to tell you that you have to realize that with a lot of these climate change questions, you can answer it by yourself. I mean, I know a little bit about climate change. I know what it does to the Arctic sea ice. I know a bit about how the Arctic sea ice itself is important for climate change. But I can't, you know, it takes a biologist, you know, somebody who's expert on plants or maybe animals, to tell us more about, you know, how that affects wildlife. Okay, so that's sort of a little disclaimer here. From what I know, there is, there are examples of where animals or plants have gone extinct because of climate change. But the interesting thing is that climate change isn't just a change in air temperature, and that's the important thing I think to point out here. Because as you change the air temperature, you're also changing the vegetation, so you're changing the plant life. And as the plant life changes, some of the climate itself may change again, you know, because if you have a forest, inside a forest, it's certainly not as windy as, say, on the tundra of the North Slope or in Kotzebue or Barrow. And because all of these changes are linked and one change can actually trigger another change, it is very difficult to say or to answer or even ask the question of whether it is only climate change and no other reason. And a good example for that, for instance, is all these animals in North America that are gone now but were present, you know, about 15,000 or 12,000 years ago. Do you know of any animal in North America that has gone extinct, you know, large animal that's not around anymore after the Ice Age?
Woolly mammoth.
Woolly mammoth. Good example. Let's take that one. So let's ask Andy here. Andy, do you have any idea where the last woolly mammoths existed on Earth? Andy's sitting next to me. I'm sort of, you know, I'm asking a question. As you can tell, you know, I mean, I don't have answers for everything. Neither does Andy. But I'm pretty sure actually the last woolly mammoth existed on this little island off the coast of Russia called Wrangel Island. And in fact, they had woolly mammoths there as late as about 4,000 years ago. And one of the reasons people suspect that woolly mammoths there survived for so long is that this island was somewhat isolated. People, as far as one can tell, didn't actually affect the woolly mammoths there. They didn't hunt them or anything. So they survived quite a long time. But then, because of the climate change that came about as a result of the end of the Ice Age, even those woolly mammoths eventually died out. But they didn't just die out because it got warmer. Wrangel Island actually is a pretty cold place. But because the plant life on the island changed, and that eventually left the woolly mammoths with lots of stuff that they either didn't like to eat, or even if they ate it, didn't really do them much good. So eventually they died out. So that's one example of how, it's not just the climate change, not that it's just a change in the air temperature, say, or in the amount of sunlight or in the amount of wind you have, but it's a whole combination of factors. And I think that's probably true for us as well.
Perhaps a more direct example of climate change leading to the extinction of flora and fauna is coral reefs, which exist at a very, very specific water depth. If the water's too deep, they don't get enough light. But if the water's too shallow, then the tide goes out and these coral reefs dry out. And so coral reefs are very, very sensitive to sea level rise, which is one thing that we're very concerned about as a global community with climate change. And the geologic record contains many, many examples of coral reefs that have been killed off as the sea level has changed up and down throughout geologic history, sometimes as a result of climate change.
Okay. The Hansons, can you ask question number 16?
Okay. This is Felicia. How do you know where to drill for ice core samples?
Good question.
The first thing has to be, is it safe? You can't drill on ice that's too thin.
See, that's, okay, so that's Andy's answer. And then I would say, if once you know that it's safe, and the question is how do you find out if it's safe, well, you know, you really have to know what you're doing, I guess, or you have to have somebody who can walk out in front of you. But once you know that it's safe, then you look for a spot that you know will help you answer the question that you're asking. So, for instance, if we wanted to know what is the thickness of the thickest ice, obviously we wouldn't go and drill in spots where we can already tell just by looking at the ice that it's pretty thin. But then, on the other hand, you know, with the ice core samples, often we're interested in learning more about how the ice grows, and we wouldn't want to drill a core where the ice is completely mashed and jumbled together, because that'll make work much more difficult for us, because we can't really interpret what the ice core is telling us. So those are some of the questions that we ask when looking for drilling sites.
Okay, Dalbanils, can you ask question number 2?
Yeah. How do you study climate change if you have only been studying it recently?
I guess as a race, we've only been on this planet very recently, but the processes that have gone on the Earth's surface before now have left some kind of record in the rocks, in the big, thick ice sheets on places like Greenland and Antarctica, and they leave us clues. And we've only been studying those clues for a short time, but we're learning and we're getting better at how to interpret those clues and get an idea of what the climate's been doing in the last several hundred thousand years.
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it. I mean, what do you think, you know, if you think back, for instance, let's think back a billion years ago, you know, long, long time ago. What do you think if a geologist studies rocks that are a billion years old, what do you think the smallest amount of time or the smallest change in time that a geologist can actually study a billion years ago? I mean, for instance, say you have a layer in a rock and you can just barely make out the thickness of that layer, say it's a couple of millimeters thick, what do you think is the shortest amount of time that a geology can study in rocks that are over a billion years old?
I don't know.
You don't know, huh? Yeah, I don't know the exact answer either, but I do know that there's rocks that are over a billion years old, and people can actually study the seasons in those rocks. They really have a layer for the spring and summer, and then another layer for the fall and winter. And by doing that, you know, because the solid rock has preserved these layers, you can learn something about the seasons a billion years ago. And I think geologists and people who are studying past climate, they're called paleo climatologists. Paleo, P-A-L-E-O, means old, basically. These people are learning more and more about the climate of the Earth as far ago as or as long ago as a billion years.
All right. The Hansons, can you ask question 17?
Huna's here. Hello.
Hello, Huna.
This is Luke.
Go ahead, Luke.
If the Arctic temperature average increased by 10 degrees, what would happen to places like Anchorage or Juneau or Fairbanks?
Good question, Luke. And hello, Huna there. Good to know that somebody is listening down way southeast. Now, first question to you, Luke, is are you saying 10 degrees Fahrenheit or 10 degrees Celsius?
Fahrenheit.
Okay. Because that's obviously a big difference, you know, almost factor two difference. Now, what do you think? I mean, what do you think would be the most? And let's just compare Juneau and Fairbanks. I think those are two extremes, and the students down in Huna can probably tell us something about Juneau. But if you just compare Fairbanks and Juneau, and you imagine that you were to increase the temperature by about 10 degrees Fahrenheit, about 4 or 5 degrees Celsius, what do you think the most significant change would be? Any ideas? For instance, Luke, think about what would happen to the snow.
It'd melt faster.
It would melt faster, exactly. And if you think about Fairbanks, for instance, in Fairbanks, the mean annual temperature, any idea what the mean annual temperature in Fairbanks is?
And, I don't know.
Well, just a guess. Do you think it's above or below freezing?
Above.
Oh, actually, it's below freezing.
Really?
Fairbanks has a mean annual temperature below freezing, and that's why you find permafrost here. I mean, permafrost means, you know, it's ground that's frozen forever, or at least for very long periods of time. And if you were to increase, and in fact, the average annual temperature in Fairbanks is about, I think it's about 26 degrees Fahrenheit or something like that. I'm not quite sure. It's a couple of degrees Celsius below freezing. So if you were to increase the temperature by a couple of degrees C, or 10 degrees Fahrenheit, suddenly the mean annual temperature would be above zero, or above zero Celsius or above freezing. What do you think would happen to the permafrost?
It would melt faster.
Yeah, it would melt faster. And in fact, if from all we know now, if you were to keep this up for a long period of time, possibly all the permafrost in most places would be gone if you increase the temperature. And if you look around here in Fairbanks, you see that there's actually quite a few houses built on permafrost. Now, those houses would have a pretty tough time preventing themselves from getting sucked into the muck. Now let's just look at Juneau, on the other hand. Anybody in Huna want to tell us what the average annual temperature in Huna or Juneau might be?
Huh?
Annual temperature.
Did they ask us something?
Yeah, annual temperature.
What do you think? Is it above or below freezing?
I don't know.
What did you say?
I wrote it. You said annual temperature.
I don't know. Don't ask me. I don't know anything.
Oh, come on, you guys. You just have it too good down there, because your annual temperature is above freezing. It's actually quite warm down in Southeastern.
Alaska.
Doesn't feel like it's warm to me.
Hey, just come up here and we'll show you. No,
I've already been up there. I know it's cold.
Okay. But okay, so let's think about this a bit more. So if in Juneau the temperature would increase by 10 degrees Fahrenheit, nothing much would happen to the permafrost because there really isn't much permafrost, if any at all, over in Juneau or in your area. But then, on the other hand, what do you think would happen to the glaciers?
Melt.
They melt, exactly. I mean, if you increase the temperature, they melt substantially, so there'd be just much, much more water coming out of the glaciers. And the interesting thing is that one of the questions we can't answer right now, and I really don't know, but I suspect that, in fact, the melting would be much, much faster as compared to the amount of snow that's falling, and as a result, the glaciers would probably shrink even faster than they're already shrinking now. And in fact, right now, most of the Alaskan glaciers are shrinking, and they're shrinking as fast as they ever have for the past couple of hundred years. So that's just one example of what could happen. But 10 degrees, even though if on an average day, you know, if you go outside and it's, let's say, you know, 30 degrees Fahrenheit or 40 degrees Fahrenheit, that doesn't make much of a difference. But 10 degrees change over an entire year on average makes a huge difference. And in fact, the difference between the last ice age, or the last maximum or coldest period during the ice age and today probably isn't, you know, is about 15 degrees to 20 degrees Fahrenheit at the very most. So it's a huge change in temperature.
Wow. Okay, Huna, do you have a copy of today's questions?
Yeah.
Okay. Can you guys ask question number 18?
If temperatures increase in the Arctic, what would happen in the lower 48?
I'll pass that on to Andy here. He's spent more time in the lower 48 than I have, so he might know.
Well, that's another of those very good questions, very complicated ways in which the lower latitudes interact with the high latitudes like us up here. But I guess one of the things that Hayo and I and Don and Tom up in Barrow were talking about a lot was albedo. You remember about albedo?
Yes.
So if the temperatures in the Arctic increased, as Hayo suggested, so that the average temperature was above melting, not only would the permafrost melt, but the snow would be around for a lot less time. Now, what does snow do to albedo?
I don't know.
I don't know.
Does the snow make albedo go up or down, do you think?
Up.
Down. Yeah, that's right. 50-50 chance. Good guess. So the albedo, if the snow melted, would go down. And so the higher latitudes, like the Arctic, would warm up. And they'd carry on warming up. And that change would be passed down to the lower 48, probably after a little bit of time, but it would cause a great deal of variation, and you would get changes in weather systems. You might get increases in the occurrences of extreme storms and such. And so the actual outcome is very unpredictable, but is likely to lead to more extreme types of weather.
Okay. The Albanil family, can you ask question number 3?
Yeah. How do you measure carbon dioxide in the air?
Good question. Actually, if I would have had time today, I would have read up on this properly. But I'm not a chemist, so I'll just give you my understanding of how people do it. Basically, carbon dioxide, if you remember, do you know the term greenhouse gas, right?
Yeah.
So a greenhouse gas, and carbon dioxide, in fact, is a greenhouse gas, does something to the way sunlight or heat, basically radiated away from different surfaces is trapped in the atmosphere or in the air layers. And the same effect people use if they want to measure how much carbon dioxide is in the air. And what they do is they shine light or electromagnetic radiation of a particular wavelength through a volume of air, and then they can tell by the amount of light or of heat that's absorbed by the air at a particular wavelength how much carbon dioxide is in there. So that's, from what I understand, how chemists measure carbon dioxide. So it's an indirect method, and the good thing about that is that you don't actually have to even sort of grab a sample of air, but you can have sensors that just suck in the air, and they continuously measure this as they're sucking in air, and they can even measure it remotely without you having to take a sample of air in a gas cylinder and taking it to the lab.
Okay. Hansons, can you ask question 19?
Okay, this is Tiana. If temperatures increase, will trees start to grow on the North Slope?
Good question, Tiana. What do you think would happen?
Well, because the temperature might go up, maybe the ground will be more receptive to light, to plant life, so maybe.
Yeah. And, I mean, even, you know, if you think about it, even in permafrost, you can have trees growing. I mean, they're just not very big, but, for instance, here in Fairbanks, there is a lot of trees growing out on permafrost. So I'm not even sure, and again, you know, that's the problem. I really don't know exactly, but I suspect there's other factors that determine whether you can grow trees on the North Slope or not. But there's an interesting observation that one of the scientists working here at Fairbanks at the Cold Regions Research and Engineering Lab has made. He has actually found, they compared aerial photographs that people took of the tundra near Nome in Alaska. And in the 1940s, they people flew along little creeks and streams, and there were no trees out there. And now people took photographs of the exact same spot about 60 years later, and they found that there's a lot of small trees, you know, well, we can get to what kind of tree in a minute here, but there's a lot of small trees growing along these streams. So in fact, there's a good indication that at least some trees will actually be able to grow on the North Slope. Now, if you think about this, what do you think these small trees that are now showing up for the first time in, you know, a long period of time as it's getting warmer, what do you think, what type of tree would that be?
I don't know, birch, pine maybe?
Well, birch, actually, no. Most of them are actually willows. Willows are really hardy, and often they're the first kind of tree that shows up way earlier than spruce, for instance, and you can have willows that are so small that you can hardly tell them apart from a little ground covering plant. So willows certainly are ones that will be showing up very early.
Okay, Huna, can you ask question number 4?
Is Alaska your favorite place to work?
Well, let's see what Andy says.
Yes.
That was a good brief answer. And you know what? My answer would be yes as well. And in fact, maybe I'll tell you why in my case. I actually moved here from Germany 4 years ago. I moved to Alaska from Germany. And I mean, I think Alaska is a great state. You know, it's great living here in Fairbanks. People are great. It's a very special place. But it's also, from the perspective of work, it's a great place to work if you're studying snow and ice, because Alaska really has a lot of snow and ice. And I think, in particular with the university here and other research institutes and the surroundings, we probably have one of the best environments or the best places here in Alaska to study these processes in cold regions. So I think... And you'll probably find that if you talk to a lot of other people here as well,
that for a lot of us scientists, Alaska really is our favorite place to work and obviously also to live.
Okay. The Albanils, can you ask question number 5?
Yes. The sun cycle affects the northern lights. Does the sun cycle affect the ice?
Good question. Now, what do you think the sun cycle is actually doing? I mean, a cycle, if you have a cycle, something's changing. So with the sun cycle, what do you think is changing?
The amount of energy given off.
Yeah, so basically what's changing is the amount, sometimes you can think of it, sometimes the sun shines brighter and sometimes not. So the amount of energy or the amount of heat that's received by the Earth is changing. And that in itself, you know, if you think about that, you would think, well, hey, you know, that must affect the ice, right? Well, sounds like everybody agrees. The interesting thing is that the amount of change in the heat that's received by the Earth during a course of one of these solar cycles or sun cycles is not all that large. And right now, there's a lot of debate going on, and I don't think anybody really knows for sure whether and how the sun cycle affects the ice. And the problem there is that the variations in the sun cycle or in the amount of heat received from the sun are only one part of the equation. There's lots of other variations, for instance, in the air temperature. There's variations in the amount of heat that's coming up from the oceans and lots of other factors. And because of that, it appears as if really at this point in time there's some evidence that the sun cycle does affect the ice, but only indirectly. And nobody's really sure whether that's actually true and, in fact, how it works specifically.
Okay. Hansons, can you ask question 6?
Okay, this is Felicia. Does ice forming and melting help clean the ocean?
I'll ask Andy about that. What do you think?
It's not going to... The ice growth doesn't do anything that actually removes pollution or rubbish from the ocean. But if something gets frozen into the ice somehow, then a lot of the ice does flow out of the Arctic Ocean and into the Atlantic Ocean. And so it's, the ice is certainly a way to move pollutants and rubbish around and perhaps make it somebody else's problem. But I don't know of any way that it actually cleans the ocean. I'll hand it over to my advisor, Hayo.
Well, I have to say, I'm not aware. It's as Andy says, you know, ice is important in moving stuff, you know, and this is both, you know, particles, little particles of rock, as well as dissolved stuff like salt. Ice is important in moving around stuff in the oceans, both up and down and sideways. But I think overall, it doesn't have a big effect on cleaning the ocean. And in fact, one thing I should mention is, if you have areas where you have a lot of ice melting and a lot of ice coming, drifting into a small area and then melting there, you can even find that if that ice is carrying, let's say, sediment particles or minerals or rocks or even some pollutants, then in fact, those are being enriched in the area where the ice is melting. One such area is the Greenland Sea. That's the sea just east of Greenland, where there is a lot of ice melting in a very small area. And people are, in fact, concerned about some pollutants that get deposited on the ice surface from the air actually being concentrated in this area.
Okay, Huna, can you ask question 7?
Is greenhouse gas growth directly related to population growth?
Good question. Have you seen now this let's turn this into a math question. If population growth,
if you think about population growth over the whole Earth, any idea how the population is growing?
I did.
I mean, is it growing fast or slow, or is it shrinking? Well, I guess nobody really knows, but it's growing quite fast, at least at this point in time. And in fact, there is a term for this called exponential growth. And basically, you can think about this. You know, if you have three children, you know, you've got three kids later on, and then those three all have three children, and then their nine grandchildren of the original parents have three each. You know, you can immediately see that the population grows very, very fast. And in fact, if you look at the world's population, that's basically what's been happening for, you know, as long as we can tell, certainly for the last 1,000 years or so, is in fact that the rate at which the population grows has actually been increasing. The population hasn't been growing at a steady rate, but the rate has been increasing. And in fact, if you then look at a curve, and that's really something you need to do, if you want to find out about this, need to do yourself. If you look at a curve that shows how the amount of carbon dioxide, which is one very important greenhouse gas, has increased, you find that carbon dioxide also grows or has been growing exponentially. And there's a lot of arguments. If you think about, well, where does the carbon dioxide come from? It comes from people running their cars. It comes from people heating their houses. It comes from industrial production and other processes. And obviously all of that also depends on the number of people. So there seems to be a pretty direct link between greenhouse gas emissions and population growth. But again, you know, there's something we can do about that. It just requires us to be a bit more ingenious about, you know, finding other ways of producing energy, maybe, or just finding other ways of reducing greenhouse gases.
If I just add something to that, though, the fastest-growing populations in the world are not the countries which are producing the most carbon dioxide. Carbon dioxide release is probably going up fastest in the developed Western countries, Europe, the USA, Canada, other countries like that. But those all have relatively stable populations. And as Hayo said, it's not just the population, it's sort of the energy consumption of that population. So even though we may think that we're a stable population, we've got nothing to worry about in the Western world, we've also got to think about the amount of carbon dioxide that we're putting into the atmosphere.
Interesting.
Yeah, that's a good point. Andy is quite right on that. Good point, Andy. Thanks.
The Albanel, can you ask question number 8?
Yes. I'm Willie. Is there an Arctic ozone hole? Does it affect the ice?
Hi, Willie. That's also a good question. I mean, the first part of the question is easy to answer because, yes, there is an ozone hole in the Arctic as well. It's not big or as deep, if you want to say, or potentially as harmful as the Antarctic ozone hole, but there's also one. In the Arctic, though, there's very few areas as far north as where this ozone hole occurs, so that people are not as much affected by this as they are, for instance, in countries like Australia. But the other part of the question, you know, does the ozone hole or the ozone itself affect the ice? And I'm now thinking about the sea ice in particular. If you would have asked me about 2 years ago, I would have said, come on, you know, you got to be joking. You know, how can that be? I mean, all the ozone does is regulate the amount of UV radiation, ultraviolet radiation, that reaches the surface of the Earth, and that ultraviolet radiation really is not all that important with respect to the amount of heat that it represents. So if you would have asked me 2 years ago, I would have said, no way. But since then, I've learned a lot by reading and talking to other people, and in fact, scientists have also learned a lot. And right now, there's very interesting research that suggests
that in fact the ozone and the amount of ozone in the uppermost parts of the atmosphere, several tens of kilometers above the Earth's surface, that the amount of ozone there does have an interesting but very complicated effect on climate. And right now, I'm not sure whether anybody really understands how this works, but people seem to find that changing the amount of ozone does something to the way the upper atmosphere moves, and the way the wind patterns of the atmosphere, upper atmosphere, the heat, the heating of the upper atmosphere. And even though that in itself doesn't really directly impact us because we're several tens of kilometers below, there seem to be very, very complicated processes that then link the upper atmosphere to the lower atmosphere, and in fact do appear to have some effect on, for instance, the distribution of wind patterns and the distribution of weather patterns. So very, very good question. I don't really think there's a clear-cut answer to that.
Okay. Hansen, can you ask question number 11?
All right. This is Luke. Do global warming and global cooling balance each other?
Maybe, let's see who, I mean, what is global cooling? Do you have any idea?
No.
Neither do I, actually. I'm not quite, I mean, basically, this is a very interesting question, and we could probably spend the next 20 minutes just talking about this, because what we know is that, I mean, there's periods where the Earth gets warmer and then periods where the Earth gets colder. And the closer we look at climate, the more variability and changes from year to year and from decade to decade and from century to century we see. So in part, I would say that you can actually have periods where the climate does take a little turn into the colder or cooler climate, and then it comes back up again. So you have all these wiggles. It's going up and down, just like the weather in one year is not exactly the same as the weather in another year. And that, in fact, makes it very difficult to tell what the overall trend, if there is a trend at all, or what the overall development is, because it's just going up and down and up and down all the time. And if you think about these periods where it's going down, you know, in effect, the Earth, for some reason or another, is receiving less energy during those years, or maybe the energy that the Earth is receiving is being stored someplace else, and then it comes back out later. And one such place, for instance, would be the oceans, where you can store a lot of heat. So it's very difficult to tell how these warming and cooling periods balance each other. And I think that's ultimately a question that a lot of climate scientists are asking themselves, because if you can answer that, you know, then you may be able to have a very good answer for a lot of problems that people are wondering about right now.
Okay. Huna, can you ask question number 12?
Do only certain gases contribute to greenhouse effect, or do dust and ash play a part?
I'll ask Andy about this.
dust and gases in the atmosphere actually have quite a complex effect on weather and climate, but generally an opposite effect to what we think of as greenhouse gases. Greenhouse gases like carbon dioxide, methane, actually water vapor, not many people think of it, but water vapor in the atmosphere is a very important greenhouse gas. Those all go to warm up the lower atmosphere and the Earth's surface. Dust and ash in the atmosphere, however, can actually block sunlight and reduce the amount of heating from the sun which reaches this Earth's surface, and so actually lead to generally cooler temperatures. So dust and ash, I don't think, are generally thought of as greenhouse materials.
So So if you take into account what Andy has just said, you know, what do you think the effect of volcanoes on climate is?
It would cool it.
Yep, exactly, because, or at least the most immediate response would be cooling. And in fact, there's very good examples of this. One example, for instance, right here from Alaska, would be the eruption of Mount Katmai. Anybody know where Mount Katmai is?
Valley of the 10,000 Smokes.
Yeah, all right, Valley of the 10,000 Smokes, exactly. And I think in 1912, in this Valley of the 10,000 Smokes, which is on the Katmai Peninsula, it's sort of southwestern Alaska, there was a huge eruption which basically blew up, you know, half of a mountain, deposited as far away as Juneau. People still had several inches of ash that were coming out of the sky. People even had ash coming all the way down to Seattle. And in fact, if you go to Greenland, on the other side of the globe almost, you can find ash layers in the ice in Greenland from this Katmai eruption. And that eruption was so significant that it definitely affected weather, resulted in a much, much cooler summer and cooler winter for a period of about a year. And there's other examples. For instance, there's a very famous example from the year, I think, 1812, 1813, where a very big volcano erupted in Indonesia, and the eruption was so strong that the amount of ash and dust in the atmosphere basically prevented, I mean, that year, 1812, 1813, is known as the year without a summer, because there literally was no summer. It never got warmer than temperatures in wintertime all over the northern hemisphere. So volcanoes play a very big role.
Okay, Albanils, can you ask question number 14?
Yeah. Does climate change human life expectancy, or only the quality of human life?
Wow, that's a tough one. Actually, I mean,
depends where you live in the world. I think there are some areas in the world. Bangladesh comes to mind first of all. There are very low-lying places on the world, and if the sea level changes significantly, they could actually lose the vast majority of their fresh drinking water supply. And one would then, I think, expect their life expectancy, not only their quality of life, but their life expectancy to go down tremendously. I can't see that someone living in a high-rise building in New York, though, is going to have their life expectancy significantly decreased by climate change.
But I think, I would say, to me, again, that's a very good question. You know, and again, I mean, I'm not a, you know, I'm just answering not as a scientist, but just as a human, just like you guys are. I mean, I would think that the two are really linked. I mean, I think that, you know, if your quality of life is diminished, in a sense, you know, even though you may live to be as old as you are, you know, your life in general has changed very much. And I think those people out, for instance, in Kotzebue, and in particular in neighboring areas where the changes in the CS regime, or even Barrow, where local climate change has affected substantially how people hunt, how they travel over the ice, how much they have to do to combat erosion, you know, because the ice is not protecting the shores anymore. I'm sure that they could really tell us a lot about, you know, how it's affected the quality of their life. And again, I can't really say, but I suspect it's those two are really very much linked to one another.
Okay, I'm gonna run through everyone here to see if you have any last questions. Hanson, do you have anything else you want to ask?
Can we come and visit you at your office?
Oh, that's a tough one. I'm just about to
leave on a cruise. I'm going to be going away for about a month and a half on an icebreaker, but we'll have to see whether we can arrange something. I'll probably respond to an email about that. But right now is actually not a very good time because we're really busy here. We're packing boxes and we're just about to leave.
Okay, what about the Albanels?
How much does the ice core weigh, the machine that cores the ice?
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's a good question. Now, there's two different types that we use. One is actually operated with an electric drill, you know, just like the one that you would use, you know, a power drill that you use to drill holes. So that's not very heavy. That weighs about, you know, maybe 2 pounds or so. We use a heavy-duty drill. And then the corer itself is made out of fiberglass, so it's not too heavy. It weighs probably about 15 or 20 pounds.
Then you put a core of ice inside that, and it gets quite heavy.
It gets real heavy, exactly. And we also have gas engines that we sometimes use if we don't want to use a generator, and those can be quite heavy, too. They can also easily weigh about 15 pounds.
Okay.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
And Huna, do you have any more questions?
Have you ever seen a constipated polar bear?
Now, what was that? A constipated polar bear?
Yeah.
Well, you know what? I was actually yesterday I was telling the story about these polar bears that we saw that were eating a lot because they were feeding on these whales that got frozen to the ice. And one of those polar bears was pretty, you know, was pretty big. He was dragging a pretty big belly. So, but I would recommend you ask a wildlife biologist about that. I really don't know much about the biology of polar bears.
What is your study?
Oh, I'm a geophysicist. So I'm really mostly studying physics and the chemistry of ice in particular.
Okay, this is Patrick again. I'd just like to say thank you to all of you who have asked questions and sent questions in. I've been really impressed by the quality of questions, lots of perceptive stuff, and I've had a blast on this Arctic Alive expedition this year, and I hope you have the opportunity to join us in future expeditions. So go ahead and check out the website this afternoon. We'll have the final diary entries and all the other stuff on there. So, goodbye.
Bye. Bye,
bye guys.
Bye.
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 Bye.